maker on May 26, 1999. So John J. McCloy Jr. was in partnership with...
With John J. McCoy.
John J. McCoy, how
can he... He was president of Coastal States Gas, which was a big gas company. And he asked me if I would come to New York and talk to him about it. And he wanted to hire me. And so I had a, I was working for DuPont, and I had to go back to Wilmington, and to get to Wilmington, Delaware, I had to go to New York. And I said, well, I can come, I'm coming back there to Wilmington, and I can stop in New York and come and see you. And he said, fine. And so I did, and I flew to New York, stayed in a hotel, and went to see him. He had an office in the Radio City Center, Rockefeller Center. And they were both there, and they had a bunch of papers there that, and it was obviously a scam. But they, like so many people who were involved in these scams, they even though they were supposedly bright people, they knew more than anybody else. And they were bound and determined to invest in this property. And I spent a whole day with them and finally convinced them that they shouldn't go into this because
it was, made it so obvious to you that it was a scam?
Well, yeah. The first thing, anytime anybody mentions platinum and platinum metals here in the United States, you know it's a scam.
Okay.
But all of these scams, or most of these scams, they generally have an ore deposit that contains platinum and palladium and other rare elements besides gold. And or if they will take a, they claim they will make a concentrate, a copper concentrate. Well, they sell the copper, they sell the sulfur, they sell the silica that's in it, they sell the limestone that's in it. And they add all of these things up at market price, you know, and it's very apparent that it's a scam. Whereas all of these things should go into the tailings, you know. Well, anyway, I sent him a bill, and he refused to pay for it. I refused to pay for half of them. I told him, you can pay for half of my expenses on the way back, and so it'll save you some money. Well, anyway, he refused to pay for it, and I went to my attorney, and he says, you've lost the money. There's no use trying to sue him in New York. You'd have to have a New York lawyer and so on. From then on, whenever I didn't know anybody, I always asked for a retainer in advance. Another interesting job that I had was when I was with San Francisco Mining Associates was for the New Guinea government. And at that time, Gold Fields of Australia, which was a subsidiary of Gold Fields of South Africa, well, Gold Fields of London, excuse me, they had been jointly exploring the Porgera deposit, P-O-R-G-E-R-A, up in the highlands of New Guinea. You had to fly from into Port Moresby and then get a little plane into Lae, and then we got a chartered plane into up into the mountains, where this deposit was, a little town up there, and I can't remember the name of it now. We flew in on a mission, a plane owned by a mission, and they brought, it was used to bring supplies to these various places, where little towns that had missions. I can find it if you write it down there. And, and then we had to, we flew from there on, we stayed the night there, and there was a little bit of a motel, about four rooms, I think. Mostly grass huts. Joe Wargo and I did. We were there together. Henry didn't go. And what we were looking at was the government wanted us to see the drilling that they were doing and they were planning on doing and what the ore looked like and whether it could be beneficiated properly and whether the test work was being properly done. And
this
so
was
on.
Gold?
Gold. And when we flew into this mine, it was remarkable because the airstrip was on a 15-degree slope. Now, you came up the Brunswick Hill down here. That is a 9.5% slope. This was 15. And and it was, he came in at the bottom of the hill, of the airstrip, and as soon as his wheels touched down, he applied full power, because if he ever got stopped at the bottom or anywhere near the bottom, he couldn't get the airplane started to get up to the top of the hill. They'd have to tow it up there. So by applying full power, he got it up to the top of the airstrip. And we were, and then of course he took off downhill. I don't know whether any airstrip in the world has ever been any steeper than that, but that was certainly a steep one. And we stayed with the exploration crews that were there for both Placer Development and Goldfields. And
how did you happen to get this job from the government? Did you have contacts?
The New Guinea government was using a bank here in the United States called Mace Westpac, MACEWESPAC, Western Pacific. It's an Australian bank and had a New York office. And they had asked the bank to look up some people who could look at both geology and metallurgy to check on the lessees of the property. And so they called us up, and so we were up there for several days, Joe and I, and first we went to Australia and talked to Goldfields, and then we went to Port Moresby to the Ministry of Mines, and the minister was, of course, an indigene. You don't call them natives anymore, you call them indigenes. And while we were there, we visited the parliament when it was in session. And there was probably 50 people there in the parliament building, which was a nice modern building, very nicely designed. And about half of the people in the parliament were dressed in suits, and the other half were dressed in their very best native costumes, as feathers and mm-hmm. everything. It was quite a sight. And we also visited their museum, the Natural History Museum, which was absolutely fantastic. It was not big, but it was done so nicely. And then we went up, the name of that place was Mount Hagen, where H-A-G-E-N, where we landed after we left Ley.
How do you spell Ley?
L-E-I? L-E-I, I believe it is. It's on
I,
map.
That's what I think. Okay.
There was an Australian up at the site who had gotten a license to mine up there. And they had been mining gold up there for many, many years, and he lived in a house that was it was a big house. It was the only house at the site. He was about a mile away from the site. And the house was all kind of moldy and about ready to fall down, but it must have had 6 or 8 bedrooms in it, none of which he used, except one, I guess. And he employed a number of these indigenes to run a sluicing operation, and there was coarse gold up there, and he also bought gold from the indigenes that had their own little spots around. And we visited with him, and he showed us all of the different kinds of gold that he got out. Every spot there had a different characteristic. You could very easily tell where it came from. And anyway, we turned in a report to them and said that they were doing very well, and that they were getting their money's worth, the government would be getting their money's worth. And it later turned out Placer Development bought out Gold Fields, and they have been operating that thing. And it has been one of the richest mines, gold mines in the world. They ran into some enormously high-grade ore there. Going back a minute to scams. I have a section on scams back in the way in the back, but let me talk about this one. I got a call from a man by the name of Bert Applegap, and he was a Canadian promoter and mine promoter, and he was one of these non-stop talkers. And anyway, he asked me to come down. They were looking at they were in partnership with a company called New Cinch Uranium, which was a reputable uranium company up in Canada, on a property, a gold property in New Mexico. And it wasn't a very long distance from El Paso. It was probably 50 miles. Well, I never heard of Applegap and never heard of New Cinch Uranium, and I told he said they were doing some drilling there, and he wanted me to check into the assaying and the sampling. And so I told him I'd had this experience with McCloy, and I told him I'd have to have a retainer, and he said that he would meet the airplane at El Paso with a cashier check, so, which he did. And then we went up to this site where they were doing the drilling, and then we went to the assay laboratory, which was in El Paso. And they were getting such rich values there. And I just had the feeling that with these great assays they were getting, you know, I should be seeing some gold there, and visible gold. And I borrowed a bucket and used it for a gold pan when I was up there. And it's very crude, but it can be done, and at least you can see the larger piece of gold, and I couldn't find any gold. But I didn't say anything to them about it at that time. And then we went down to this laboratory, and this fellow had a kind of a general water chemistry laboratory, and he had a fire assaying laboratory. And he had a man from ASARCO that had been an assayer for ASARCO, who I'm sure was honest. But this man who ran the laboratory was also buying electronic scrap. And he had almost a washing machine that he would put these things in. It looked like one of these old Westinghouse vertical or horizontal drum washing machines. Mm-hmm. He'd made it out of stainless steel, and he was cyaniding this stuff. And all this gold from the electronics. And he was pouring gold there, and he was doing them, pouring little gold ingots right on the same table where they were mixing the fluxes for the fire assaying. Well, it was very apparent to me that the assays were being salted. Now, whether they were being salted on purpose or whether it was just from accidental contact with metallic gold there, I don't know, never did know. But anyway, I told them to change laboratories, which they did, and then they began getting nothing. And actually, I was working for New Sense Uranium. They were paying my bills. And so they, when they started going to another laboratory, they got absolutely nothing, and they closed the project down. It was, as I say, I never figured out whether it was a complete scam or just as far as the laboratory was concerned, or whether it was completely by accident. How much more time do we have?
Well, here. All okay, right. We've taken a short break here. And now you were just talking about Timothy Collins and a company called United Mining that was going to open the mines at Virginia City, Nevada.
Right. And another company, well, first of all, Howard Hughes had got involved, wanted to get involved in mining in Nevada. And he, one of his employees that he put in charge of, he just told him to go buy mines. Mm. And this man bought a large number of claims all over Nevada of old, where old mines had been and were defunct. And he had bought some property, one of the properties he bought was some in Virginia City. Near Gold Hill. And but then when he died, Howard Hughes died, all of these properties were purchased by an outfit called Houston Oil and Minerals. And they were trying to operate a plant there between, well, it was closer to Virginia City than it was Gold Hill. And they had were developing an open pit there. And they had brought a mill down from Canada that was, they had wooden ore bins that they'd brought down. And the bins were, they got one of them re-erected, and then it collapsed. It was so bad, the lumber was so bad. And so then they put in some steel ore bins, and they had six wooden pachuca tanks. And a pachuca tank is a large, a tall cylindrical tank where you do your cyanidation, and you keep them agitated with air going into the bottom of the tank. Pachucas were used at Homestake's uranium mill there near Grants. And these were leaking all the time. They were, it's a wonder they even stood up. They were doing, I went through the mill when I was there, and it was very poorly designed mill. And I'll get back to that in a minute, but Collins had hired a very fine tunneling engineer, and they sank an adit, or a decline, down, the entrance to it was probably three blocks or more down the hill from the main street of Virginia City, and it went down at about a 10-degree angle and went through the vein structure, which was right underneath the main street of Virginia, Virginia City. And they had a lot of problems. They had to timber all the way down. The ground was so loose and running, as we call it. They timbered all the way, and then they got through the vein, which had been mined out, or mined, they had been mining up to within about 200 feet of the, or 300 feet of the street in middle town. And then they had turned both right and left when they got through this vein and mined out portion of the vein, and drove a short adit to the right, and I don't know which direction that is, but I would presume east, and a much longer adit right under the main street, and right in line with the main street, clear to the end of town, the west end of town, and then drove crosscuts back into the old workings. And these workings were all square set stopes, and you couldn't get in. You could look in, but you didn't dare go into these because the timbers were all crushed, and it was.
They were there from 100 years ago, I suppose.
Yes, and we went down. Joe Wargo and I and Henry, we all three went down in that mine, and or it wasn't a mine yet. And we did quite a study for him, and he was doing metallurgical work, or having it done, and I supervised that. And he was selling some of the material that he took out of this adit to Houston Oil.
Now he is Collins?
Collins. Okay. Selling it to, or having it custom milled in the Houston Oil Mill, and had plans on taking it over. But and we wrote, we were over there several times and wrote quite a long report about it. And we weren't really enthusiastic about it at all, because, well, Joe particularly thought the ore was, there wasn't much ore. They were going to mine up toward the street. Because those mines, you know, had been very deep, a couple thousand or 3,000 feet. And when they finally got, they were essentially worked out. The only good ore was up near the street, and you couldn't get too close to that, and the whole town would cave in. Well, anyway, Collins ran out of money, and he didn't pay us, and we had to sue him to get paid. But in the meantime, the Houston Oil people wanted me to come over and help them with their mill, and they had a very good mill superintendent by the name of Bob Turner, who I later got hired to go up to Landusky's Ortman in Montana. And I was helping out Bob getting this old plant straightened out. And it was an interesting job, but it was kind of frustrating, because you knew that, or I knew that, they weren't going to last very long. They had tried to open up the old Sutro Tunnel that drained, was supposed to drain all the water from the Virginia City workings there. And, but most of the tunnel had collapsed, and they never could get back in there. Houston was another one that was going to make a fortune. They finally went under. But it was an interesting time working in that old mill that had been rebuilt, and I enjoyed it. Another job, when I was still in San Francisco, was I have a friend up here in Grass Valley by the name of Dale Corman, and he is a geologist and a mining engineer, and present time he's president of Western Copper Holdings, and they have a very large copper deposit that they have found in Mexico. At that time they were interested in geothermal power, and they had geothermal claims over in Nevada, and they had sold one of them, or leased it to Chevron, who runs a geothermal power plant over this side of Carlin. And anyway, he called me up one day, and he said, "Why is Homestake looking for pyrite?" And I said, "Well, this was when they were planning on building the McLaughlin mine." And I said, "Well, I had to think about it a little bit, but they were going to use autoclaves. Homestake was at the McLaughlin mine to oxidize the pyrite that most of the gold was entrapped in." And the sulfur in, they had pyrite in their ore, and the sulfur furnishes the heat in the autoclave, but I said, when I thought about it, I said, well, Homestake probably thinks that they don't have enough sulfur to furnish enough heat, because I do know that they are putting in boilers over there to furnish high pressure, high temperature steam. And I asked him why. He said, well, they had been prospecting all over California and clear up into Oregon for any old prospects, old mines, or even new ones that were high grade pyrite. And he said they've been doing this for about a year and a half and spent a lot of money doing it. And I said, well, undoubtedly they think they need the sulfur. And he said, well, I know where there's 40,000 tons of pyrite that not only is pyrite, but it contains a quarter of an ounce of gold. And it is at the Empire Mine here in Grass Valley. And this was, this pyrite concentrate was an idea of Frank McQuiston's when he was chief metallurgist here. And they had made a flotation concentrate, which they originally, at Empire, they cyanided all of the ore. But then when flotation came in the 1920s, they produced a flotation concentrate, which they cyanided. But part of the gold was associated with galena, which is lead sulfide. And that and part of the gold was in the pyrite. Frank put in a circuit to separate the galena from the pyrite, and they made a high-grade galena gold concentrate, which they sold to the Selby smelter. And to do that, they had to put in a fine grinding circuit, and before the flotation. And then the remaining pyrite was put in a separate tailings pond from the old tailings that they had made there for ever since the 1850s. And this pyrite had actually been drilled by the Bureau of Mines. And the Bureau of Mines had done some assaying, and they had not written a report about it yet.
Okay.
And he said that he knew, well, he told me that the state, which owned the Empire Mine Park, had given the rights to this, the right to sell this concentrate. And he found out that they had been talking with White Pine Copper up in Michigan about this, because White Pine bought pyrite because they had their concentrates were very low in sulfur and they couldn't make a copper mat in their furnaces, so they had to buy pyrite. They had native copper as well as cobalite, which was CUS, and so it was very high in copper and low in sulfur.
Anyway, the Empire Mine Association figured there was no way that they were going to ship that stuff all the way back to Michigan, upper Michigan. And so my friend Corman talked with the board of directors of the Empire Mine Association, which runs all the docents over there and helps rebuild buildings and so on. Found that this was for sale, and he said, "Do you know anybody in Homestake?" And when I told him about it, when Homestake was probably wanting the sulfur from the pyrite, and I said, "Yes, I do." And so he said, "Why don't you call them up and see if they're interested, and don't tell them where it is." So I called this, and I'm trying to remember the name of the fellow. He was the chief geologist that quit or was fired, I'm not sure which.
Gustafson?
No, it was after Gustafson. Anyway, I called. Actually, I called
Anderson? Jim Anderson?
Jim Anderson. Well, I had called, who was the president at that time?
Henshaw.
No, after Henshaw.
Conger?
Conger. I called up Conger, Harry Conger, and told him that I heard that you're interested in pyrite, and that I know my partner and I know where there is some, and would you be interested in it? And he said, he says we might be. And he said, "Why don't you come over and talk with Anderson?" So so Dale Corman, he came down, and we set up a meeting with him, and he came down from Grass Valley, and we met over there, and we told him that we had this 40,000 tons of pyrite that was pretty much theoretically pure pyrite, is almost pure pyrite, but it contained a quarter of an ounce of gold, and that made the ears prick up pretty bad, or pretty well. And we met with, I don't know whether you want to use names or not, but
sure.
We met with
That's
Anderson.
The whole point of it.
And we met with Rex Guinevere.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he was chief engineer, and why he was in on it, I don't know. And then there was a purchasing agent, and I don't recall his name. And then they had their corporate attorney, the four of them.
Goldstein? Denny Goldstein?
No.
Bill Langston?
He later quit, and he went to work for the Navy.
Oh, I don't know.
Relatively young fellow. I think he was probably 35 or something like that. And so we discussed this, and when they heard that, one of them asked where it was, and the attorney said, "Don't ask that." And so we didn't tell him, and we wouldn't have told him that time anyway. And so they wanted some samples, and so we got. got them some samples, and I took them over to them, and Dale sent them down to me. And they had them assayed, and they called up and asked for another meeting. So Dale came down, and they said that they were interested in purchasing, and how much would we want for it. And this work had been going on up, this contact with White Pine Copper had been going on, and we were afraid the word would get out to these Empire Mine Association people. So we determined, we agreed together to, Dale and I, to tell them that in that meeting where it was, because that would then kind of commit them. And anyway, they asked first what we wanted for it, and we had set a figure of $35 a ton. Well, at that time, gold was $400, and there was, and so a
quarter of an ounce would have been $100.
Quarter of an ounce would have been $100, mm-hmm. and plus the value of the sulfur. Mm-hmm. Well, actually, they wanted the sulfur, but they wanted the gold also when they found out it was there. And we told them that, well, we figured to mine it, and would just require a front end loader, and transport it. We had a figure of $10 a ton. No, $15 a ton. And we would pay the association $10 a ton, and we would get $10 a ton. And so we told them that, and they were, of course, very much interested. And then we said, well, now this, we have the rights, we've been talking, we've been given the verbal rights to sell this, to purchase this stuff. And he said, and we said, it is at Grass Valley at the old Empire Mine. And the lawyer didn't want us to tell, but we got it in before he could shut us up. Well, then they wrote up a contract, and they sent it to us, and we had one other meeting, and we made some minor changes to the contract. But, and then they said, well, we're not sure we need this at the present time. And we're not sure we'll have to get the mill started before we really know whether we need this or not. And they said, we said, well, why don't we just make a handshake agreement that we will, you will buy this through us, since we brought to your attention. And they asked the lawyer about it, and the lawyer said, that's all right. And so we shook hands all around, shook hands with the four of them. And they said they would call us, and when they found out if they needed it or not. And a few months later, it was 8 months or so when the plant was built, and Dale called me up one day and he said, they're mining this stuff, this pyrite. And he said the Empire Mine Association has made this deal with a contractor from Seattle or someplace up in Washington to haul this. And he bought it and hauled it down to, was hauling it down to Lower Lake there at the McLaughlin Mine. And so at that time, by that time Bill Humphrey had come to work for Homestake. And so I called up Bill and I said, Bill, I told him about this handshake agreement, and I said, I think you owe us some money. And he said, well, of course, he didn't have anything to do with it, and he said that he would get back to me. And so he called up a few days later, and he said, well, he says, I'm sorry, he says, but we don't think that you had an agreement with us, and there's nothing we're going to do about it. So I said, well, I think I'll talk to my attorney. And I had worked for done some expert witness work for John, I'll think of his name in a minute. And his partner David Hoy, John Miller, who was in Elko, and David Hoy is in Reno, and they, on the litigation part, they hired a litigator who was an expert at the courtroom thing. And his name was Greg Wilson, and he was in San Francisco. And Greg was just a tiger in court. And he put on the most remarkable performances. He had a so-called expert in another lawsuit, who was from Reno, the expert was, and he asked him a question, and this fellow said, yes, positively, yes, yes, answer it. And so then he started asking other questions, and I could tell that he was going around in a circle, and he asked about a dozen questions. And this guy kept giving answers back. And he finally came back and he asked the same question he'd asked at first. And the guy says, no. Mm-hmm. And then he just tore into him. And he was just a little puddle of sweat on the floor. His coat was absolutely soaked through with sweat. Mm-hmm. Anyway, I went to Greg and I told him about this, and he says, I'll take this on and win it for you on a contingency, no cost to you. He says, we'll not only take them for the $400,000, but we'll get you the $400,000, but we'll get damages. And so he said, by this time, that lawyer, Homestake's lawyer, was working for the Navy, and we would subpoena him and get him to testify under oath, and subpoena the rest of those fellows. Well, neither Dale nor I wanted to really get involved in a lawsuit because it, being a consultant, and I was working for other mining companies, and I didn't particularly want the word to get around that I was suing a mining company. And Dale, being president of this company, he didn't, of his own company that he was president of, he didn't really want to get involved in a lawsuit. But I called Bill up again, and I said, Bill, I've got, I went over to see him, and I said, I've talked to this lawyer, and he says that we not only have, he's absolutely certain that we will take you for the $400,000 plus some damages. And I said, we want a settlement. So he said, well, let me talk it over. And he came back and he offered $25,000. And I said, no, that's for both of us. That is 12,500 feet. Well, we finally got, if we'd have held out longer, we could have got more, but we held out and we got $50,000 apiece. And that to me, it was...
What do you suppose their reasoning was in not continuing to deal with you?
The contractor from Seattle or Washington turned out to be a cousin of the purchasing agent. And the purchasing agent had gone to his cousin and told him about this. And then the contractor came down here and made the negotiation. He was ready to offer the association a contract right then, and so they took it. And that was just plain crooked. A purchasing agent. And for the Homestead people to go along with something like that when we had this agreement, it was just, to me, it's unthinkable. Anyway, that's the story of.
So that's how the Empire Tailings ended up over there.
That's right. And the Empire Mine Association really lost on that because they only got $9 a ton instead of the 10. And there was no cleanup work. And we had promised them that we would clean the thing up, all of the tailings, and reclaim the pit and bring in topsoil and all that.
It had been in a pond, you said.
It was in a separate tailing
right.
pond.
Yeah. But it had drained.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, there's crooks in all businesses.
I guess so.
It's now,
do you think that's a good place to stop?
Yeah, that's probably a good place to stop.
I think so.